Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's good, internet? It is Monday, September 29th, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio episode 100. It's Friday. You're going like opposite. How are you? It's not episode 100. Why are you whispering?
This is now an ASMR podcast.
No, it's not. You can't do the ASMR podcast on our 100th. I have to be like,
it's Friday.
We're trying to keep 100, and like,
I don't know if you knew, but it's Friday. It's Friday.
Don't rub the microphone. Danica is rubbing a microphone in, frankly, an inappropriate manner.
Monday.
This podcast just sounds
haunted.
Well,
there is no way it's not. There's no way it's not haunted.
About our haunted podcast. Welcome to our haunted podcast.
Demonic possession.
Are we supposed to be live? Are we supposed to be streaming?
No. No, we are not.
Making sure.
I didn't know if, yeah, weird, huh? You know, I've been thinking a lot about our history as a podcast.
Yeah.
And we've run into lots of trouble with streaming devices and boxes and cables. But I will say this, not in a fucking bunker anymore. 100 episodes ago.
We were in a bunker.
A year ago, actually. It was like the last week of September when Patrick and I launched Vice Gaming's new podcast.
Huh.
I had to stand and like had my computer leaning on a tiny little sliver of nothing and was recording into a USB microphone.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know,
it didn't take 2 hours to start recording, though.
Yeah, I was going to say,
Two and a half.
That's the weird thing. We've always talked about this, of being like in this weird middle space of like, we are not, we don't do lots of, we don't do like a live show every day from a studio space at this point. We only have like two cameras in here, not five or something. Other people use the equipment and use the setup and use the room. Like we share it with other podcasts.
Well, we now have a nice helpful sign. I know
we
we're
do
not
a sign.
Streaming, but I did make a helpful sign the other day.
Yes.
That sign also
says,
looks kind of haunted.
It is haunted because a ghost helped me write it, but it does You
have to talk into the microphone.
Love of all that is holy, please don't touch anything.
And that anything is underlined with a squiggly underline.
Yes, I made a squiggly underline. That's where the ghost really helped
very
guide
spooky.
My hand.
It's very spooky. Just in time for Halloween.
But what I will say, like, the thing that's always been weird about this stuff is, like, it would be easier for all of us just to do it at home, but at a level that's, like, really good for at home.
Yeah.
And then there's this huge middle area, which is, like, not like TV broadcast, and that's the area that like lots of people have to figure out because it's like, oh, you're using TV broadcast like cameras, but not TV broadcast soundboards. We're like trying to figure it out.
I will say, if we would have recorded from home,
we
would have been done 2 hours ago
and streamed it.
But your boy had a meeting.
The Skybound of podcast prep.
Yes,
you know.
Hey, you saw that I got a response about that movie's release date, right?
No, you didn't.
No.
Fill me in.
Yeah, so, well, we should probably set this joke up, right? No? Maybe
yeah,
not?
Yeah. Set it up.
Well, there's no setup. It's that other people on Twitter started talking about this movie Skybound, where the tagline is, what is it, like, what if the ground was gone?
Yeah.
But you were in a plane. That's an important part. You're in a chartered, like, private jet, and suddenly the ground is gone.
What do you do?
That's an enticing turn of phrase, I think. What does that mean?
We don't know. The trailer is extremely good. It is right up my alley. It is like my wife has gone to sleep, and I don't have the energy to play a game. I want to have another beer, but I need a justification for it. And Skybound, like there's a specific type of movie, like Mimic, Skybound, like that's in that realm of film. And anyway, so I encourage people to look up Skybound. One, you have to put in Skybound 2017 movie.
Yeah.
Because if you search Skybound, you're going to get the parent company that is owned by Robert Kirkman of The Walking Dead. That does a bunch of other things.
SEO is hard, okay? SEO is
tough, man.
So this trailer, which came out last December, I thought for sure that I'd be able to pay $3 on iTunes and watch this weekend. Like, I was legitimately excited to procure this film for my enjoyment, and instead it's not out yet. And so I found their Facebook page, which has 300 likes, which must be the production crew of that film. Which is
Wait, you think they had 300? They had 300 people on that production?
That's their intern.
I think it might have been like 266. I might be rounding up.
Plus family. Definitely hit likes.
I just put in, I saw that it had just opened to Japan, which I was like, okay. There was a Japanese poster. So I just responded to the Facebook thread that had like 3 likes and was just like, yo, when's this movie coming out? And then I got a response last night that said, oh, we should have U.S. options shortly, which I think will just mean it's going to be on iTunes.
Did it say it was
literally?
You can buy options to this movie.
Patrick, this has to be the image for this podcast. It's you just saying, hey, is this movie out yet? No punctuation, no capitalization. And then Skybound the movie says, Skybound, all caps, was released in Japan last month. U.S. will follow soon.
Wait, but didn't it just say something about it being premiered at New York Comic Con, or was I just reading Google wrong?
I think that was the Robert Kirkman thing.
Of course.
It's got to be specific on what you Google search for with Skybound.
I want to say something. There was also the Skybound Stratus trampoline with full enclosure net system for $584, which is like a netted trampoline. Can we get one of those?
I have an idea. All right, we're going to have a Waypoint party where we watch Skybound while jumping on the trampoline the whole time.
I got a better tagline than what if the ground was gone? Uh-huh. What if the ground was a trampoline?
What if the ground was bouncy?
What if all of the ground?
Fuck the plane. I don't know if I can do this.
But like, and you're looking down from the plane and everyone's just bouncing all over the place.
Everywhere.
So they can't stop.
It'd be like the end of Con Air, but it's 2 hours long.
Can we add that mode to Battlegrounds?
Yes, please. Brendan, please add trampoline ground. Next weather effect. The ground's a trampoline now. Can't stop jumping.
It's a great idea.
In Skybound, there's a moment where they look outside the window and the bison are on fire. And
God,
they're
that's
just
so good.
Running.
Why are they
and
on fire?
I don't know. That's why.
America is burning. It is 2017.
Yeah. Is it a metaphor?
All the symbols have been lost.
Yeah.
Is it a metaphor? Austin, what do you think? Fucking bison are running across the burning plain. That might be a metaphor?
Was Dr. Steinman a metaphor?
I legitimately need to know the answer to the mythology question of this movie. Like, I want to know why the ground is gone, why the ground was okay before they got on. Then the ground, someone has stowed away on the plane and said, you cannot take this plane into the ground. Why does that guy know that the ground is going to get fucked up? I need to know the answers to these questions, which is how I figured out the movie wasn't out yet.
He used bison. He knew they were up to something.
Only one person has said bad movies.
There are reviews over IMDb, a thing worth noting here. Do you want to read one of these? Which one? Do you want to read the bad one?
Yeah, I'll read the bad one. Ready?
Okay, this comes in from MichaelFun69.
Okay, nice. This is a terrible movie. Acting is terrible. It's like a school project. People walking freely on plane with the door open? Bullet wound recovered so fast? This show is a joke. Is this made for television? I've seen lots of trashy movies, and this is the worst of all. The two white actors have done better shows. The ladies acting are worthless to even mention.
Oh.
Wow.
Is this CinemaSins?
Is this from a NeoGAF thread?
This is a NeoGAF thread. NeoGAF reviews Skybound.
Everybody else loves it, though. The other 5 people.
This person says...
Like, what did that person expect going into this fucking movie? Like, he's like, Skybound seems... You know, seems interesting.
Seems
like,
legit.
A little disappointed in the logistics of the plane in the air. Like, what the fuck? It's a trash TV movie that you find on Sci-Fi. Come on.
Of course that's what it is.
I like the 2012 meets Speed.
I'm going to read this one from Aldrich Banks, who says, for the first 10 minutes, you'd be thinking it's a low-cost, no-plot film showing a bunch of teens indulging in their fancy lives. Private plane, colored lovers, multiple relationships.
Wait, what?
Even when the fake cult leader, any cult is fake, literally, appears, there is still no interesting clue at all. It adds a bit of flavor when there are mysteriously many planes hovering in the air. And nuke apocalypse.
Don't spoil too much of the movie.
That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, we can't go further. We can't go any further.
That's all I'm going to say. The rest of this
does answer some questions.
Please don't. Yeah, please do not spoil it. Like,
it does say that the
verdict keep getting more racial.
Yeah, that's the part I need to know about.
It does
here.
Say that the movie would be more delicate and compact if cut to 40 minutes. You guys ever get the Skyrim mod that made everyone more delicate and compact?
It's from the creator of Clean Faces.
Uh-huh. This is actually just like fresh and entertaining. We watched this on a Saturday night with some friends staying over, and
where did they watch it?
Time.
Do they have a copy of the movie? How do I get it?
That's how it was edited. That's the editor of the film.
Yeah, they made it.
His friend is the director.
Still only gave it 9 stars though. I like that. This person really gets into the
I love that first line. I love that first line.
The film gets exactly what you've been thinking and feeling for many years now, that a huge disaster or terror attack could happen at any time. What would you do in such a situation? How would you put together the pieces if you only had limited information? The film picks up all these questions and turns them into an action-packed thriller with a finale that I never saw in a similar movie before.
I'm in.
Why do they ride bison back to the ground?
I don't know. We're not going to.
I hope they do.
Here's one final line. This is from the 2012 Meets Speed review from Miami, Florida. The first line is just, "You can't slow down because." You can't slow down and land because the ground is ... gone.
Incredibly good.
That's the plot.
Thank you for being an investigator. Thank you for being a journalist, Patrick. I appreciate your rigor in this and all of your endeavors.
I've liked the Facebook page. I need an update to that thread. I need to know when that movie's available.
You're the only non-bot like on that page.
Oh, probably true. God. How's everybody else doing? Does anybody else have any disasters?
Well, it depends how you define disaster.
Well,
I had a disaster on a plane recently.
Oh, that's right.
Did the ground disappear?
No. The ground did not disappear, but all semblance of human decency did. That definitely happened on this plane. I went to Scotland. I had an amazing trip. It was the time of my damn life. And then on the way back, there was a very drunk man and a very drunk woman hitting each other and yelling at each other.
God.
And we almost had to divert the plane. And
With
fists, yes.
Wait, what?
Yeah, they were hitting each other. And I went and I told the flight attendants, who, you know, later on broke them up, but...
Were they Scottish?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Everybody I met in Scotland was wonderful. Okay, so I'm not going to say that had anything to do with
people.
I met these people.
You did a lot of fighting in Scotland, though, didn't you?
I did, actually. I did Muay Thai and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu almost every day in Scotland.
Yeah, but you thought that was like just like you went to a gym and that's like, you didn't realize that's...
You do it on a plane when you're coming from Scotland.
All through Scotland.
That's what it is.
So how did this get broken up?
Well, eventually the flight attendants physically broke them up and made them separate. However, they figured out that I told on them. So the guy was threatening me for like an hour. And I was sitting right in front of him. So I thought I was going to die.
So he just like quietly like...
He was quietly... Oh, so he talked about how people with brown eyes are evil. He talked about how there are children dying in Mexico. So we need to get some perspective and don't complain about him. He talked about... Yeah, I am verbatim. I wrote this down. I wrote down notes of the things he was saying to me in case I needed to make a police report at the end.
Fair.
Oh, my God.
It was really pretty
intense.
Sounds
like everyone had a good week.
I'm glad I wasn't there because I would have straight up turned around and smacked his face.
Sticks up their arse, assholes. Anyone with brown eyes is a nutcase. Going to slap them, going to kill them. Then there's the whole...
Oh, my...
There are people dying in Mexico, and these assholes are complaining about me. And then he started calling me sleazy and a backstabber. And
you know this guy? Wait, hold
up. I've worked hard all my life. I've earned this holiday, and they complain about me. I hope you fucking die now, bastards.
The Scottish version of Curb Your Enthusiasm is way darker than
God. That is like... That is a horrifying story.
It was a little bad.
You just have to ride that out, or did the flight attendants maybe take any further action with
They eventually separated them, and they kept
separating him from you.
What's that?
But not you.
Separating him from you.
No, they didn't do that. Thanks, American Airlines. On blast, baby.
Fuck.
Jeez Louise.
So I thought I was going to die the whole time.
I feel like me complaining about wires is way less interesting. But
well, you know, you can complain about wires.
It's not the same.
Wires
Danielle,
are terrible,
can you
too.
Them up?
Oh,
100%.
Question.
Oh, 100%.
No.
100%.
Question. I was actually
you
the whole
hoping
time.
You'd start something?
Honestly, a little bit.
Oh, that would have been so good.
But the only problem was that my back was to him by necessity, and that's what made me scared. If I was watching this guy, no question, I would have knocked him out with two punches.
How was no one else tattling on them?
I think they were. Okay. It's just that I was right in front of them,
close.
And they saw me tattle.
Yeah.
So.
Did they say tattle?
I think they said snitch.
Grassed.
Snitch, yeah.
Wow, they called you a snitch.
You should have gotten out.
They've got some street
You should have gotten your bag down, gone, like when you landed, gone out front, and just be like, what? Like, what's good?
Like, you wanna do something about this?
Put your
a drunk old man.
Hold your luggage until he's coming down the walkway, and then just drop it. Like just been boom. Like,
hey.
Yeah. Put in fake.
I'm right here.
You want to go to sleep?
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah. Look at my brown eyes.
Exactly. Look at my brown eyes. I'm a nutcase, baby.
God.
Anyway.
That disaster doesn't sound. I was trying to throw to a much less intense disaster. That one's good. I'm glad we got to talk about it on the podcast. But Rob was saying that he had his own self-imposed catastrophe today.
Yeah. I kind of fucked up.
Oh, no.
And I think where this begins is when I was living in L.A., I got used to gaming on a big screen TV with a 5.1 surround system. And that was pretty cool. I kind of liked that. I was like, this is good.
You didn't bring that out? You didn't put that on the truck, that system?
God, like, transporting anything cross-country, like, triples, like, the like basically, it's three times the value of what the good is actually worth new. Mm-hmm. So it's just not worth doing. So no, like basically I like left my apartment in LA burning behind me, which I felt pretty guilty about when I saw the pictures from earlier this month.
Jesus Christ.
But you know, that's neither here nor there. So I decided, what if my home office had a surround system? And then I thought, well, what if I had a TV in addition to a pretty good monitor? And then I was like, what if I just had a 55-inch 4K TV?
That's big.
In my office. And
is it on the wall? Is it? Rob's picking up a camera. One second.
Rob's here we
picking
go.
Up his
webcam. We're
his
going
web
on a
cam.
Journey. We're here going we on go. A little trip.
FK homo, motherfuckers.
That's very big.
It's a nice size monitor.
It's a lot of screen. And
that's just steam. You just have steam up. Okay.
Yeah.
So
it's
you turn and face it when you're playing a game? Is that what your deal is?
So this is where things are starting to go wrong. I mean, it's the newest area where things are starting to go wrong. So my computer never had a problem with, like, a dual monitor setup. Like, that was fine. That was cool. But it turns out that it doesn't really like running one display off a direct input and another through an HDMI input on a receiver that's outputting to a 4K TV display with a lot of different settings.
Yeah.
It also has its own settings that sometimes like to conflict with what the computer's trying to output. And so I'm still figuring out how this works, and there's a lot of like weird arcane rituals I have to go through to make this really work.
Goat also, heads, lots of blood of doves.
Yeah. Also, 4K is a lot of pixels.
It's too many. I'm good, actually.
It's a lot.
I have a 4K TV. Like, I'm all right.
Yeah.
I'm not sitting that far away from it.
Yeah.
It's, like, if things look okay good, on that actually. Screen, they're enormous on the monitor. It's kind of tough, but I will say I've started playing I think it's still embargoed, so I'm
a video
playing
game.
A racing game that looks real fucking good in 4K.
Oh, I bet. But that's, like, that's why you get a 4K TV.
Yeah,
three
right,
things.
Right.
Nature documentaries, racing
birds,
games.
Mm-hmm. Cars.
The third one. What's the third one?
It's not porn.
I was going to joke and say porn, but I was like, no,
it's,
I'm good,
it's
actually.
Not porn.
It's not. I don't need 4K porn in my life.
The review embargo is up, Rob, so you're free to mention what that game is.
Okay, yeah.
Wait,
Forza
is he, wait,
7.
Is that the one that's up, or is the other one? There's two car games that we gave Rob code for in the last week.
Well, but Project Cars 2, that one is already also
okay,
fun.
So we're good.
We're good.
It rhymes with Quartza.
Yeah, Project Cars, that was a week ago.
Okay. So Forza looks good?
Yeah, like, good probably doesn't describe it. I had a race this morning that was at Spa-Francorchamps, which is a really well-known racetrack. In, like,
you don't have to explain that to us, Rob. We know what that is.
Okay. But anyway, like, so I was driving, like, a 1967 Ferrari F1 car, and it looked fucking rad. And I'm driving around this track, and it's, like, kind of a misty gray, like, Ardan forest type, like, it's kind of menacing and brooding. And then it starts to fucking rain. And it's raining in parts of the course, but not others. And it was, like, ridiculously... I'm looking at it, I'm like, oh, so this is just, like, a portal into another reality where I'm driving a 1967 Ferrari F1 car. Because, like, it just looks... It looks real.
Right.
Like, to the point where it's actually a little distressing. Because, like, you start... Like, Danielle and I have talked about this. God, what was it? You were playing Dirt.
Yes.
About the rain effects, the weather effects in that game. this is a similar boat where, like, it's starting to get that same, like, tense across the shoulders feeling you get when, like, you can't see out of your car, but you're going real fast.
And you're like actually something... driving in real life, and it's terrifying because you could die.
Right, yeah. But there's like something like something in your blood that in your lizard brain that's like, no, that's real. This I'm gonna get into a car accident. My ancient caveman ancestors did not like getting into car accidents.
Yeah, once they invented the wheel, that's what happened every time. It was really scary.
They got to go slow in the rain.
Yeah,
but yeah. So I mean, that's been rad as hell. But overall, I have to say, I think 4K might have been a bridge too far in some ways. Certainly for my video card.
Yeah, you'll catch up. You just got to get a new video card and then a new CPU.
A new machine. New eyes. You know.
Yeah,
new eyes. Yeah. That's what I need. That's someone send me some new eyes. Need. Don't send me new eyes. Please.
Don't know where they came from.
I don't have our address out. I don't want anyone to send me new eyes.
Right.
Send them a new UI.
That's it. God. All right. I think, are there any other disasters to report, or should we dig into this episode 100 question bucket?
Oh,
no
bucket.
Disasters.
All right. I'm going to start with a pretty light
Wait,
one.
Wait, who saw the Bear game last night?
Oh,
shut up.
Patrick is wearing a Chicago Bears sweatshirt.
He's right,
it's a good thing we didn't stream, because we'd be getting a lot of comments about that.
It's true. Oh, we would be. Let's start with a light one. This one comes in from James, who wishes
King
to happy
James.
100th, and who says, what is one game that you would like someone else on the podcast to play?
Okay, that's on the spot, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But there's a lot of people. There's 5 of us on the podcast, so like that's going to be enough for us to generate.
I think I want Patrick to play Dragon Ball FighterZ.
But I've played a fighting game. This is a fighting
game.
That's
the thing.
I think isn't like the heart of the question is like
Ultimate,
something that would like
Ultimate
be
Ultimate Ninja Storm. Naruto Ultimate Ninja Storm.
That's a different anime fighting
no,
game.
No, there's a story. The story is extremely
okay.
good. Yeah.
Okay. You want him to like get the Naruto story so he knows enough of it so you can make Naruto references.
Yes.
And he'll be like, oh, yeah, I get it. Yeah. Gaara.
Yeah, so I can talk to – so I can be like, hey, Sasu Naru, huh? And then he'll be like, yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah. I think he knows what that means anyway.
No, he doesn't.
He had a knowing look.
I think we all know in our hearts.
Nasu Sara?
Other way – okay.
I feel like I just said something racist. But...
yeah, probably.
Oh, God.
Oh, no.
Any other good ones here?
I'm trying to think. We all played Battlegrounds, so it's like that would have been a game that I would normally want to thrust on other people.
I want Danielle to play Battlegrounds.
Me too. Brendan, add controller support
please
to the PC version
support.
Now.
Please add,
people
please.
With fucked up wrists.
Please. Rob, I feel like, has a war game for each of us.
Yeah.
Gosh.
I picked up Command Ops for you.
Okay, thank you.
Danica's getting Valkyria Chronicles.
Oh, yeah, that's
a good
one.
I do need to play it. I do, yes.
You do.
Yeah. I kind of want...
Danielle's definitely getting Ultimate General Gettysburg.
Yeah.
Not Civil War. Gettysburg is probably the strongest.
That's the one.
Gettysburg.
That's the one.
Patrick,
I'm going to Gettysburg.
Patrick... you know, he's a bright, details-oriented guy. I think he can do anything he sets his mind to. You get Gary Grigsby's War in the East.
No.
That sounds complicated.
Yeah, you know what? You're right. Rise and Fall of the Third Reich.
Hey, Nazis are very in right now, so.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, that's a shame. I want everyone to play Romance of the Three Kingdoms...
the new one?
No, not the new one. The last PS2 one is the one that I want everyone to play. I think it's 11 is the one that I want everyone to play because it has like an RPG mode where you get to just be one person but also like go on quests and then fight in the Romance of the Three Kingdoms era. It's it's really good.
That sounds good.
That's all.
I have a really Danielle answer.
Yeah.
Which is that I want everybody to play a game that I love but all together with one controller. Like all 5 of us playing Banjo-Kazooie together. With one controller.
Like passing it around?
No, as in like the controller is here.
I fucking hate this.
And we all have like a button.
I fucking hate
can we get a big version of the controller at least?
Yeah, sure.
Like
course.
A bigger version of the N64 controller.
Absolutely. Like you could use your legs
like
with the analog stick.
It's like whack-a-mole basically.
Right, we're like jump.
Yeah. All right.
So what
you have like 2 buttons each.
You want Space Team, but a platformer.
Yes, Banjo-Kazooie.
That's pretty cool.
Okay.
I'm pretty into that. Netrunner is my other answer always.
Oh, yeah.
All right. I think that's everyone. But Patrick, did Patrick have an answer?
I'll think of one throughout the podcast.
Okay,
nothing comes immediately to mind.
I'm sure you'll find it though. This one comes in from Craig. It's a little bit longer, and it's about industry stuff. Happy 100th episode. So my question involves the monetization of games and how they are evolving. Microtransactions have encroached on game design to the point where many online games ostensibly use capitalism or avoiding capitalism as a game mechanic. When I play games with limits to how much I can play without paying for extra stamina, it quote-unquote stamina or energy, you know, things that have gates like that, it alters how I play games. When a pay-to-win mechanic in games where not paying puts you at a disadvantage, so you need to gauge how much you are willing to min-max when you pay versus struggling through content, it becomes the content. The struggle becomes the content. In some ways, this mechanic can actually feel fun, either by buying power or overcoming a severe disadvantage to accomplish something without paying extra for it. Do you find strange satisfaction like I sometimes do in avoiding or embracing those restrictions? Do you think the shifted focus to embracing a perpetual pay structure presents interesting gaming elements as well as feeling pretty shitty because of how it separates wealthy winners from everyone else? Then again, capitalism fucking sucks, and I would rather games don't become capitalism simulators. Anyway, sorry for the text wall. Thank you for your wonderful insights. Here is to the next 100 episodes. Peace, Craig from Baltimore. What are your thoughts?
I kind of love microtransactions. Like, it's,
do
it's,
you?
Yeah, it's bad, but I get like a weird, I don't know, like, I was really into like playing Crazy Taxi, yeah. And I honestly didn't mind watching ads. That felt kind of fucked up.
Well, they had the good thing about Crazy Taxi, what was the actual name of their mobile game? Whatever it was called. It was like Crazy Taxi
something millionaire.
Gazillionaire. Yeah. Was like they did the fake ad before the real ad.
Yes.
And so always like,
yes.
That was like this weird thing where it injected a little like stimulant. I'm like, oh, that's a funny fake ad. And then they give you the real ad. And you're like, this is a bad looking mobile game.
Yeah. And I'm playing Wiz Khalifa's Weed Farm also. And that one has a lot of the same.
How's your Weed Farm going?
It's going pretty well. It's going pretty well.
Is everyone in Petaluma playing Wiz Khalifa's Weed Farm?
In real life, yes.
Yay.
Good.
And also like Fire Emblem Heroes, I don't know. I kind of just really dig like gacha games. And
that's the thing, is like I actually super enjoy gacha games to the point that part of what I'm enjoying about Endgame Destiny is that it's turning into a gacha game, which is like, oh, I'll go out, I'll get some Engrim. Like Engrims are already just a gacha system of like, oh, I'm gonna put in some time and then receive a drop and
open
that drop.
I've spent money on Bright Engrams.
Yeah, me too. I've also spent money on Bright Engrams at this point, which is like bad because I hate that system and that system should be bad.
Oh, God.
But what I actually just like about it is like, in the same way that I like Fire Emblem Heroes, I was like, oh, I'm going to finish the story mode or the story like level and I'll get enough coins to get a pull from the stuff. I do the same thing in Destiny with the powerful Engrams every week, right? Where it's like, oh, I'm just going to clear this out. I think, Patrick, you've written about Destiny at this point as being a thing that takes a lot of time. But Polygon just ran a story that was like, you only have to play Destiny for 5 hours a week now. Like, that's what.
Oh,
Destiny
just five
has
hours.
Oh,
I know.
Awesome.
I know. We'll compare that to what.
Let me just go find the time bucket.
Well, like,
and
the
just
thing
pull 5 hours out of there.
You say that, but I got a text from someone who linked me that piece today, and she was like, that's not a good thing. I want to play this game for 20 hours a week. This is like what she used to do was like this was her game with friends.
Right.
She got to play it. The way that some people play Overwatch and they play it for 20 hours a week. The way that some people play Battlegrounds for 20 hours a week.
That's fine.
But
I'm
like,
not judging. I just have no idea how an adult can do that.
Adult, there are various degrees of free time for adults, right?
That's
like,
true.
You, the way, like, imagine someone who doesn't grapple, who doesn't do EMT stuff, who has a lot more free time.
Oh, I've been putting, like, 20 hours a week into Destiny.
Like this. This is how an adult does it. And also, Danica works her ass off, so it's not like...
I know. Danica does work her ass off. That's why I'm saying...
I do it in between, you know?
Like, anyway.
I know. Yes.
For me, the thing
Danielle, your version of free time is equivalent to my version of free time, and that we should not compare our versions of free time to other adults.
To other adults. Right. Yeah. So the thing is, like, the thing that I like about the five-hour a week... So for people who don't know, in Destiny 2, the way it works is that every week there are like six things that reset that let you get a really powerful item.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like do a bunch of stuff in the PvP mode and that'll give you one. Or do the flash or the whatever the flashpoint is that week. Do a bunch of public events on a specific planet. And each time you do one, you get to turn that crank of the gumball machine and get yourself a new piece of gear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really satisfying.
It's really good. Love to pick up legendary Engrams all the time.
What if you get a legendary and you open it up and it's yellow and it's an exotic? It feels so good.
That's
that real shit. And the thing that's like fucked up is I like that way more than if there was 20 compelling hours every week of stuff. Like, I do just want that little 5 hour.
Can I ask an honest question?
Yeah.
So I just must be completely on the outside of this because to me, like, the most rewarding thing in a game is like, it feels great to jump. It feels amazing to move around in a world. Like, the thought of that sort of element of chance of just like, oh, you're working to get a reward.
Yeah.
I don't think I can wrap my head around it.
First and foremost,
which I must just be missing something.
I think Destiny 2 just feels good. Like, as far as the shooter goes, it is just like some of the best shooting on the console market. Mm-hmm. Like, I think probably my favorite in terms of just like what the gun
is. So it is rewarding to play in itself.
But then it drops in these other things that are also, that are, that help you, for me, they help me compartmentalize a section of play as being working towards something instead of just being, and it's way better than in Destiny 1, which was like you just run the same flash, or the same, what's the thing I'm thinking of? What are the stupid, not flashpoints, the same strikes over and over and over and over again to get good drops. And like, I'm glad that I can get good drops by doing all of these different types of activities now instead of that. So I don't know. It's a nice way for me to like, hey, this is I'm going to spend an hour tonight. I'm going to get a reward. I'm going to check out of Destiny instead of feeling like all I can do is run that strike over and over.
Okay. Anyway, I feel I like gotcha.
You like gotcha stuff.
And I don't know. I kind of like microtransaction stuff. I don't know. Capitalism.
My relationship, Patrick, is your relationship with this changed? Now that you're a father, now that you have less time, where like one of the things that companies always say about microtransactions is this is for people who don't have a lot of free time and they want to skip a bunch of content. They want to be able to play with their friends. They want to be able to like jump ahead and not feel left out. Has that become any more compelling to you in anything?
I can see it. Like I would love if I could I would pay $20 to have another level 280 character in Destiny. Just give me like a generic. It's not super kitted, but it's just like, here's enough shit. So, like, I don't have 25 hours to go bring up a hunter. But I'd love to have a hunter so I could, like, roll around with that and, you know, eventually run the raid with folks and not be completely stuck on my warlock because that's what I invested the time in. So I would pay $20 to just, like, just let me skip over all that stuff. Like, let me just, I don't want to play the story again. I don't want to run the adventures again. Just give me another character and I would pay $20 for that. Or you know, I'm on the, at this point, the problem with the raid for me is not that I need a character. Like, I have a character that's essentially leveled to that. I don't have 8 hours, like a whole Saturday to dedicate to it. Right. But I could totally imagine someone who's like fumbling around at 240 and all their friends are at 280. It's like, if they want to pay $10 to just, like, skip that and just, like, get some stuff. Like, don't give them, like, the best equipment, but, like, just give them equipment so they can, like, go play the raid with their friends. Like, I don't see it. I don't see any. That doesn't seem to break the economy. That doesn't seem like that's offensive. I mean, it's offensive to people, I guess, who they self-identify around the work that you've put in. And I think that's where a lot of the rub comes with some people is that some people will actually never engage with the microtransactions, but they find it an affront that someone would want to engage with the microtransactions. Yeah. When I think if they're implemented properly and it doesn't kill the skill and time arc for people that want to do that, I don't see the problem with that. If it's done properly, because I think in Destiny, you've bought the bright engrams, but I don't think the... No. I don't like that system, but I don't think it breaks Destiny.
No.
All it does is if you want to pull the lever again really quickly, like they've given you a system to do that really quickly. And sometimes you find yourself falling into that trap where like, I haven't gotten something good in a while. Well, fuck it. I'll pay $2 or whatever it is to engage with it. But I don't think it breaks Destiny as much as like Destiny has a really good gotcha system, like a really good slot machine system that you – so you don't mind paying – a couple bucks to run it again. And it actually always reminds me of the way I'm playing through SteamWorld Dig 2 right now, which is an excellent game that people, if you have a Switch or PC, it's on everything, I think, at this point. It's really, really good, especially if you're like me and don't really know where your 3DS is and you wanted a Metroid-style game. Like, this is a really good one of those. It reminds me how I play all of these games where when I start getting resources and I can upgrade my character, I invest all of my resources in like the first couple of hours into resource related upgrades. Right.
Get more XP, get more money,
at the expense of everything else. Like, I don't want to be able to jump further. I don't want to be able to shoot better. Like, I spend hours maxing out, or not maxing out, but like getting a lot of time into the resource stuff because it ends up looping back around and benefiting you around the mid game. So, in the early game, I suffer. And like right now in the mid game of SteamWorld Dig 2, like, I just have way too much money. Where I can just constantly upgrade all the stuff whenever I want because I suffered through the early parts of it where I'm like, I'm just going to be a weaker character, but I'm going to have all this money and dump it all into that. So,
speaking of the Switch very briefly, the Red Hook Games, Red.
Yeah.
Announced or showed off Darkest Dungeon on Switch today on Twitter. It looks good. I'm excited that that game's coming. I'm going to buy that game again for the third time. I bought it on iPad already, too.
I'm going to buy it for the first time. I'm very excited for that. I've been always wanted to get around to it. The people like yourself and others that have written. Mm-hmm. I distinctly remember. Like, one of the first pieces I saw that you wrote was, you wrote about, like, anxiety. And,
yeah, the Darkest Dungeon,
Darkest
Dungeon
Paste,
stuff.
Right?
Yep, yep.
Yeah, totally. I remember that was one of the first pieces I saw of yours. It's always been on that list of, like, ah, I gotta try that. And,
the Switch feels like a good...
And it just, it fits in, you know, like, we have this piece that went up on the site, or it's going on the site today, about, like, traveling with a Switch
yes,
for
it's coming
for
up soon.
Today.
Yep. Yeah.
And for me, like, when I can multitask and watch a Netflix show while... Like, playing the Switch, like, is my ideal scenario. Yeah. Where it's a game that I can turn the sound off and be okay, but still engage with the game. And Darkest Dungeon seems like it would fit very well into a scenario like that. So I'm excited to finally play that game.
Totally. All right, next question.
Oh, I made it on the Daily Caller, too.
Breitbart and
a Daily Caller.
Fucking... Waypoint got its first Breitbart mention?
Oh! Ian Miles Chong! Oh, I'm on the
That's the trifecta!
There it is!
If you had your money on Ian Miles Chong, then what are you doing? But
other
two.
Games journalists like Vice Waypoint Editor-in-Chief Austin Walker.
Oh,
what's
my
good?
God.
Joined the chorus of condemnation against the ESA.
Yeah, what's good? Yeah, of course I did.
Yeah, of course.
Of course. Have
of
we
course.
Met? We haven't. I have not met Ian Miles Chong. He used to fave everything I tweeted, though, so I don't know what happened
really?
There.
Oh, damn. Well, you know.
Times, how the... Times. Say that again, Rob.
I played Left 4 Dead with him a few times.
Oh, yeah? Oh, boy. Life is funny.
You know, life has a way.
Life finds
life
a way.
Finds a
life
way.
Finds a way.
It has a
I'm
way.
I'm still actually perplexed by what exactly happened and how, because, just very strange to, like, have a casual, friendly acquaintance sort of resurface ages later, and it's like... Oh, that's feels like things have changed, man.
Yeah, changes like you know it happens.
Also, I don't need that mystery unpacked for me. Don't worry about it.
Don't write in about that one.
I don't need the timeline. Fill in the blanks with an imagined tale. I'm sure it's better.
Make
than
sure
reality.
Make sure it's a dark one.
It's
sure
gonna it's be. One. This one comes in from Cameron from Melbourne. Hey, Waypoint, I just finished the first episode of Star Trek Discovery. After watching its pilot with its allegorical Klingon fascist, I was a bit disappointed at its focus. While I think the stories that give us ways to view the present are important, in the past I've turned to Star Trek for visions of a better future. Mm. Right now, when everything seems dark, I think utopian ideas help give us hope and ideas. I was trying to think of other good utopian fiction. I couldn't think of anything in the world of games. My question is, can you think of any games that point to better worlds? And what place do you think that they have right now?
There are. They're just weird.
Oh. Battleground, beautiful utopian vision of the world. Not
Hell
a
yeah.
terrible so, allegory for our current
does
lives.
Does the utopianism of StarCraft.
Yep. There's the Terran utopian vision.
Yes.
Space truckers are the utopian future. They're still employed. They did. The automated space trucks didn't take away their jobs. That's a utopian vision of the future.
On the other hand, prison labor has become the Marine Corps.
Yep.
So,
totally.
No. But does the utopianism of Star Trek tend to get over exaggerated? Like, I feel like that's become what everyone understands of that show. But, like, I'm watching the original series for the first time, like, right now. And then there's series like DS9, a lot of memorable plots in Next Generation. The two things I'd say is, like, actually that show, like, goes dark a lot of times about human nature and, and about humanity. And the other thing is, like, whatever its utopianism is founded on is, like, devoid of political consciousness for the most part. Like, it never actually gets to, like, well, how does the society function?
Right.
So I don't know if it, like...
There's, like, a few sketches, right, Danielle? Like, you're probably the biggest Star Trek fan on this call.
Yeah, maybe.
Probably.
Rob's a pretty big fan, too.
Okay.
But yeah.
But, like, for me, it's things like the lack of money in terms of, like, need for basic needs and for luxury items. It's
the sort of backstory is there was World War III.
Right.
And everything was really, really bad and horrible, and everybody was like, money's bad. So let's have a utopian society where everybody just works really hard and has everything that they need. Technology helps with that, but also... The people who make decisions in this world, the people who are kind of on top and actually making decisions, do things like put the welfare of human beings and sentient beings in general above things like wealth. And that's kind of that. I think that's the dystopian, or sorry, the utopian sort of ideal that rides beneath a lot of it, is that the people in charge give a shit and will work really hard and will do everything in their power to actually make the world a better place. And that's continually the struggle. It's always like, okay, there's always going to be sources that make you not want to do that. There's always going to be difficulties. There's always going to be, you know, alien species that have different ideas, right. And there's always going to be Ferengi and all sorts of other stuff that kind of go in against those things, but somehow the cooler heads will always prevail, and I think that's the utopian vision of it.
Is that, like, you never leave Star Trek thinking it's all been burnt down, we've lost. It's that, like, the struggle.
There's hope.
There is hope that is like centered on human action, yeah. On a hierarchy that is not oppressive, that yes. you can actually trust to do things right, and when they do something wrong, is corrected, and that, like,
and they'll think about it and feel bad about it. Like, the captains make mistakes. Like, sure. that's definitely another through line in the series. Like, the captains make mistakes. They fuck up. They screw up all the time. But, like, they care about it and they take actions to correct their mistakes.
I think the other thing is, I think we often talk about the utopianism of Star Trek in terms of the qualities that are talked about in the Federation, theoretically about people back home, yeah. Versus what's happening on the kind of fringes of the Federation, where spaceships are going to interact with other cultures. Like, it's always kind of gestured at that, like, people on Earth got it good. Like, everything back, yeah. everyone who's, like, living in a colony, unless it's a disaster crisis moment and the Enterprise has to, like, fly in to mm-hmm. save the day, like, oh, everything was good until. And it's about kind of keeping up the structures that make sure that everyone's stuff is good, instead of, like, and ideally expanding, bringing other people into that group and into the protection of the Federation.
Yeah, things are good on Earth. In the official passport, which I had, there's actually a little passport.
Excuse me?
There was a literal passport, a tiny little book that had all the different planets that Aww. You could go to Aww. And all the things about them. Earth is in great shape. There's beautiful nature preserves. Mm-hmm. All the different cultures live together in harmony, all sorts of stuff. People think of themselves as, like, I'm from Earth, as right. opposed to, like, a particular nationality or anything.
I'm not
like
one
that.
Of those dirty Klingons, they say.
Yeah, that's a, you know, really, human nature has done such wonderful things in the world. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, like, just being in the 80s and 90s in America in this shit. Like, there's a lot of weird racial shit going on yeah. in Star Trek Next Generation. There's a lot of weird stuff. There's, like, Worf is a token character yep. in a lot of ways. He's basically, like, treated as, like, the one guy of color
who's also
sort,
like,
of,
listen, he comes from a species
right.
that is just a little angrier than most. But they have an honor. They have he's like
but
this
they have
weird amalgam
honor.
Of, like,
yeah.
bad East Asian stereotype and bad, like, African stereotype.
Yes.
It's like
yes.
it's rough.
There's a lot of bad shit.
In the original series,
yeah.
Oh,
McCoy
yeah.
just loves to remind non-human crew members that they're not human and therefore are weird.
Yep.
You're green blood, Spock. I don't know where your heart is.
He's a fucking old drunk racist. Like, yeah. that's who McCoy is. Like,
yeah. And everyone's like, just... Oh, good one, Doc.
Thanks, Bones.
That's
yep.
real good.
Fucking. What about the second part of this question, which is, like, games that actually have a utopian core, and whether or not those are valuable right now, if you can think of any.
Yeah, but only, like, weird art games
that are
just, like, explore this beautiful world, and that's it. There's no other sort of value judgment other than you're exploring a beautiful world.
Right. I think
it's not, you're not engaging with systems that have to do with monetary systems or anything right. like that. It's just, this is a beautiful place. Explore, have
but
fun.
Is that even utopian, or is that just, like, conflict-free or, like, beautiful, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I actually think that
the
games that come to mind for me that are utopian are ones that are often about self-determination, games from creators who are imagining themselves and they're a world where their identity is safer or a world where they're working through the struggle of their identity. I'm thinking of a lot of queer creators here. I'm thinking yeah. of a lot of Black creators here. Or the other side of this is this, like, the utopian neoliberal idea through
right.
City Builders. I think, like, the Anno series of City Builders of just, like, here is a world that is largely at peace. You can even hit the button that says there's no war, and then you don't have to deal with any yeah. of the bad, like, strategy game layer that's on this. And it's just a game about building a beautiful city and making sure that there's enough, you know, luxury goods for everybody, and there's enough.
No, not for everybody, Austin.
No, sorry.
Not for everybody.
There's enough luxury goods for the people who are in the highest tier, who are very very happy, and there's lots of canned meat for everybody else, and that keeps them happy.
Yeah. The workers doing are happy, all the work.
But it's a very utopian vision of society in the sense that like you don't the goal is to just balance out these meters such that everyone's happy, like and that can be done entirely through marketplace economics.
Right.
That's like the only vision of utopianism that I see systemically, the way that you're talking about, Danielle. Otherwise, it's often just like it's just like big picture metaphoric. We haven't had our Destiny 2 spoiler cast, but the end of that game is basically like, it's going to be good now. We shot enough people. And like, okay.
What about a racing game?
Our racing game is utopian. Yeah, I guess so. All you got is you in the track and the car works.
Rainbow Road, baby. Rainbow Road.
Oh, Mario Kart. Incredibly utopian.
Mario Kart.
I guess
you have equal
for blue
access
shells.
To shooting other people or like throwing bananas.
Everybody
equal
has access to bananas, to food.
What do you think?
They don't just get banana peels.
And you can throw blue shell at the richest one.
Exactly.
That sounds all right to me.
Throw blue shell at the 1%.
You can eat the rich. That's what Mario's really about. Punching dinosaurs, eating the rich.
Thank you, Mario. I think that's it. If anybody else has any other examples, I would love to know. But like, it's really hard to think of lots of dystopias in video games.
Oh, yeah.
We could go for 3 hours.
Right.
But I think that's largely because, like, games are so conflict-oriented and, like...
That's what I was going to say. It's like a utopia maybe in a visual novel or something that didn't require, like, quote-unquote mechanics.
Right.
Conflict is just easier to depict in a video game.
The thing that's interesting is, like, I think we often think about utopias as being, like, oh, it's heaven. And I think if you actually look at the history of utopian scholarship, it's always about, like, no, like, it's... Our utopia is going to be this commune that then still has to deal with the outside world, or our utopia only comes, you know, into full when the whole world is unified as a single system that can interact with each other. And even then, there will always be conflict.
There
will always
be
problems.
There never won't be. Yeah.
I would love an adventure game set in a utopian world where it's like the reveal isn't that like the utopian world is secretly a dystopian bad. It's just like you're a fixer who makes sure that things stay good. And like I can imagine a sort of what's that company that does those the point and click?
Like Wajedai?
Yeah, Wajedai. Mm-hmm. A Wajedai game set in, instead of being set in one of their many sci-fi dystopias or supernatural dystopias, set in this like actually beautiful vision of the future.
Things are pretty good.
In which your goal is to like keep it that way and not in a way that just made me sound like you're gonna get a gun and go kill like quote-unquote problems.
Right. I love that idea.
Speaking of independent game developers, this one comes in from Lauren, who says, hello Waypoint fam, I hope you're doing well and congratulations on 100 Waypoint Radio episodes. Seriously, you folks are amazing and I'm very appreciative of all the hard work you've done this far. Thank you, Lauren. I am a media psychology PhD student focusing on video games. My research methods course just had an assignment to turn in a few chapters of our textbook into a 3 to 5 minute explanatory video. Instead, I made mine in Twine. It was my first time using Twine, so it was a very simple game, but I had lots of fun and learned quite a bit. My question is, if you were going to make a small educational Twine game, what topic would you cover? Maybe something you're passionate about or something that would fit well into Twine's structure. Thank you for being so excellent, Lauren. P.S. My Twitter handle is at Chicken Dinosaur. Very good Twitter handle.
Very good.
If anyone wants to see my very first Twine game, it is pinned there. So what's the educational, what's the thing you would make an educational, let's just open it up, an educational game about in general? What's a topic that you want a good educational game about? And hey, it can be good, or it can be bad if you're like into like bad educational games.
Yeah, those are fun. I've enjoyed many bad educational games.
I used to cover them when you used to write about them
all the
ACLU.
So much fun. Point. Yeah, iCivics.org. Those are actually kind of good, to be honest. They're better than most educational games.
I'd probably make a game about catcalling. Yeah, I don't know how I would do it, but.
It seems like a good one. I feel like there's been
a couple. That would be a good educational game.
In the past few years.
Connect game, you know?
Yes.
No, Patrick, not a game.
Wow,
Not a game in which you catcall.
Yeah, no.
Oh.
Like a game to educate people about the harms of catcalling.
I thought you meant like you're punching the catcallers in Connect.
Oh.
That's what when he said that, that's what I imagined.
Like
I was like, yeah, you're
shadow
punching catcall. That sounds fun.
Yeah.
Right.
But yeah, anyway.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you.
That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You know,
cat calling on Connect. Yes. It's good. Daniel, Patrick, do you have one?
Go ahead.
Well, Assassin's Creed this week announced that they're adding this like tourist mode to Assassin's Creed Origins as part of a free patch next year. It basically disables the story and the conflict and the violence, and you can just kind of like explore the space. But
take photos, right?
And take photos, but I wish like, because I've always wanted something like that out of those games, but I wish it would go further. Like I wish there would actually like an educational element to those games, like, they were actually, like, they had a historian come in, and, like, you could, like, the same way that, like, a Valve does, or other developers have done this, but, like, where you can play a game, and then there are sort of, like, audio cues that will, like, plug in as you're going along
like
the
director's
world.
Commentary.
Yeah, director's commentary. It's like, what if they had, you know, these big, beautiful worlds like in Assassin's Creed, but then, because Assassin's Creed is just a, you know, it's its own twisted take on history, so it's like, yeah, like, it's a slice of Egypt, and they're elements of history, but like it shouldn't be taken as historical fact because it's a video game about assassins. But like, what if in the context of that, there was like an actual educational layer on top of it, which they brought in experts that were to like, hey, do you want to learn more about the pyramids or whatever? Like, there was some way that you could explore and have that actual like layer where instead of just it's a big, beautiful 3D space they spent tens of millions on, it's like you can actually come away with some sort of context for what you're exploring around. Like, I wish more games would do stuff like that, especially the Assassin's Creed games, which, like, it's...
They're halfway there. Like,
Yeah, exactly.
That'd be really cool. I would also just like a lot of director's commentary in games in general.
Yes,
like,
100%.
I think about a game like Horizon Zero Dawn, which is a game that I probably respect more than I like, or does Prey have this? Does Prey have director's commentary? I'm imagining that.
Yeah.
Both of those games are games that I would love to go back through and like have audio drops that I could hit on that I could click on to be like, hey, tell me how you built this vista. Tell me how you designed this enemy. Right. Tell me how you figured out like walk me through the steps of designing this quest. What were some of the challenges? Or the other thing is like, what is the historical background here? What is the fictional influences that you drew on while doing this stuff? And I think that would be rad.
I think like a thing that I actually really like that they had in Horizon Zero Dawn. They have it in a bunch of games, but they did a really great job with in Horizon Zero Dawn, where the audio logs that like took you back and placed you in like the time before, everybody like was. Spoilers, killed by the machines or whatever.
That's what's coming for all of us. That's just not spoilers for 2020, not spoilers
life.
For Horizon Zero Dawn.
But that was really cool. I would like more of that in games too. Just like learning more about
like
the world in the game.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
That'd be rad.
Rob, a lot of the games you play are already have not an educational element, but a historical element. So I'm curious, like, is there anything there or do you have a completely different song in your heart when it comes to information? That you want to teach?
No, I mean, I think what I'd probably do is, like, I'm always fascinated by the personalities involved in, like, so, like, war games are all about like, military history and, like, so-and-so commands this corps, but never, like, involves any of the people. It's all this, like, sort of vision of history sort of stripped of humanity and replaced by sort of mechanical relationships, but probably what I would like to dig into is something about, like, the complexities that develop like within organizations because of like interpersonal dynamics when you're trying to do like massive things like so you know a good example you know would be that you know 1914 the Germans are invading France and one of the things that starts to happen is the various parts of their army start to lose touch with each other and these commanders who had been in touch with each other and central command the entire time all start like having to make decisions on their own and they start like trying to anticipate each other and they start making misjudgments and one of the things that comes up is because there's like a lot of personal rivalry and like disdain between various members of that group the entire attack starts to completely come apart. Now there's other reasons for that but I think it could be a cool thing where, like, a big part of the game isn't necessarily about, like, making the right decision tactically or mechanically, but like just knowing who was the right person to listen to at a given moment, who's the right person to entrust with the task.
The other part of that that I love is the ways in which communications technologies can either break down or how they influence hierarchical systems in general. One of my favorite like things to go back to, I don't think I've done it all, I've talked about it on this podcast, but Harold Innes, who is this media scholar and historian from Canada, he was the mentor of Marshall McLuhan, or the medium is the message guy who like people vaguely might know. Innes wrote a lot about how different types of communications technologies shaped early cultures, so that if you had a culture that had easily transportable media, so if you had an early culture that had paper or something like papyrus, it was easy for a central figure to get out specific orders quickly to a bunch of different places. Mm-hmm. So they could, like, if they could find out how much wheat came in for the yield this year, and then could decide what the tax rate should be based on what came in, or like they would know what was happening on the frontier near other civilizations, and could, you know, leverage diplomacy in that way. Whereas other cultures that didn't have transportable technology in that way, or communication mediums, would instead be focused around, this is what Innes says anyway, core central tenets that then decentralized the government. Mm-hmm. So instead of having someone in command who was like, do this, do this, do this, they say, okay, do these basic things and everything else, like, just as long as you get these 10 commandments right that are on stone, that are hard to move around, like, yeah, everything else should flow down from those core rules, and you govern yourself based on what your local needs are as long as you stick to these core rules and these core tenets. And what's funny is Innes started thinking about this because he was a radio operator in World War One, and the sort of thing that Rob was just describing is what happened to him, which was like, if my radio fucks up, we then lose that direct connection, and we have to revert to what local protocol is, or what the protocol we were taught is, and how well you can execute on that. So, like, I've always wanted games to dig into that part of communications more. It's like one of the biggest bummers for me is playing a strategy game, especially a game like Crusader Kings 2, which is like a game I love, in which you know what's going to happen before you hit the button, where it's like, oh, this is gonna work. It says send this thing, it's going to get approved, you're good. Or even something like, it's one of the reasons why I still kind of like the XCOM system of like, it says 97% to hit. There's always that 3%. And as long as it's being honest and not fucking me, I like it. I'm good with it.
Actually, just, I think like a Twine game probably would be a good way to simulate actually a lot of things, whether you're the CEO of a company or like an ancient emperor, because like a lot of these things, games of this fantasy, like Perfect Information, of like having access to be able to verify, oh, this is what is happening, these are the causal relationships. But actually, for like a lot of people in those positions, people are just telling you shit. And you have to like assess the value of what they're telling you and the gloss they're putting on it.
Right.
And like that's one reason why things get fucked up a lot. And
Stacy
really
shows
cool
up.
Thing.
Yeah, Stacy shows up and she says, like, listen, the enemy is moving from the east, but Jim says they're moving from the northeast. Like, who has the better track
Stacey,
record?
Also, it looks good for Stacy for them to come from the east because, you know, she didn't screw something up. She's trying to cover for Jim because Jim
it's a whole
and she, they have a whole affair going on.
Totally.
And there's a
oh,
lot.
Oh, wait, there's an affair?
Wow.
Jim and Stacy are?
Oh, yeah.
I have to know a lot about the people who work for me.
Exactly.
Oh, General
there's a lot.
Walker, I got too much going on.
There's a lot.
The other one for me is unsurprisingly, like, labor organization. I had, like, a game that actually, like, communicates that. Quickly, shout out to John Boyes, who... Boys, B-O-I-S, Bois, John so. Boyes.
Yeah,
I've always
actually
said
know how to pronounce that.
Me
yeah.
either. Great, great content producer at this point. Like, used to be a really good writer, then became someone who made really funny videos, really smart videos.
You're familiar with the Breaking Madden.
Breaking Madden
series.
Is his kind of big breakout thing. He's been doing a video series called Pretty Good, which is a good name.
Yeah.
It has a really good vibe. It's just like lots of little really good stories. And the one that came out today was about the 1987 NFL strike, the player strike. Ooh. And specifically how the Philadelphia Eagles like were fantastic during that strike and like very unified, and how some other teams were not, and how that I'm not going to spoil the historical events here. It doesn't go well for the strikers is what I'll say.
Sure.
But then it kind of culminates in this amazing fuck you from the Eagles to one of the biggest anti-union teams, which was the Cowboys. Really, the biggest anti-union.
Oh, that's shocking to learn that.
Yeah, of course, right? Patrick, you should watch
America's
this video.
America's team, go
it's
fuck yourself.
It's so fucking good. And it's about Randall Cunningham, who does something incredible, who's my favorite athlete of all time.
Awesome.
Scramble like Randall and his. So,
scramble
you know,
like Randall.
Go watch that. But then I would love a game that just like digs into what the benefits of organization are, what some of the potential downsides can be. In terms, there are potential downsides, though. For me, the positives outweigh the negatives so extensively, yeah, that, like, obviously pro union, pro organization related. Buddy writes in and says, "Hello."
Go ahead. Briefly. Yes. I would really like a trauma center game that's actually educational.
That would be fantastic.
That would be like my favorite thing ever.
I mean, that must exist at this point for actual medical students.
It probably does, but it's probably not that fun.
True.
So I would like a good game that also, like, you know, the magical, mythical thing that's, like, actually a fun game and interesting gameplay that you're actually engaged
learning
with.
Some
where you really learn surgery.
But it's a mass casualty.
You really learn surgery. Exactly. And perfect. We do a lot of the stuff that you were mentioning before with, like, radios and EMS. That's actually a legit thing. We have standing orders versus, like, online medical control.
We're like, sometimes someone's like, no, don't do the standing order thing. For this person, do this because you've called
in and said. Like, there's a doctor on the phone who's like, oh, this is the situation. Okay, you need to do this thing that's not like what you usually do.
That sounds really good.
I mean, being on an ambulance is a really fun game.
I wouldn't do it for real because I'm terrified of fucking up and making someone
die. It's so much fun. But anyway, I'll be on that tonight.
Until someone loses an eye and I'm like, hey, cool, I fucked up and made this person
lose an
eye.
But then someone will just send you some new eyes.
Oh, true.
Yeah, you know.
True. Buddy writes, hello, everyone. I've been wondering something about game developers unionizing. Unionizing seems like it could lead to some great improvements for them, like more reasonable work hours, no crunch, and better compensation post-release. So my main question is, why don't they just unionize? What hoops do they need to jump through in order to form a union? Would it break down into smaller unions, like one for game artists, one for programmers, etc.? Is it a fear of losing a job to someone not in the newly formed union? Thanks, Buddy.
Danielle can probably speak a bit to this because Danielle is actually our union rep.
She
keeps me protected.
True.
I do my best.
Yes.
You know, I go out there, I fight for our rights every day. I've got my little Norma Rae poster.
You do.
Someone actually tweeted at us, just really quick, but I didn't respond and was like, oh, I'm curious about like what Waypoint's like union situation is. Are they in the union?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And
all of you are in
all
the
of
Writers
us are
Guild.
In the Writers Guild, right?
Not me, because I'm management, which is the weirdest thing.
Right.
Like, I spent the last decade studying and supporting labor activism and labor theory, and then like, oh, whoops, like, I'm not in the union. But now production just started.
Production
right?
just got unionized.
So the people who work on our Waypoint Presents TV show, if you've seen any of the short form stuff, Guide to Games, all unionized now. Which
I've been in back-to-back unions. At Gawker before this, who was also unionized, and then came here. It was bizarre because it's extraordinary to work for a place that's in a union. It's even more extraordinary to go union to union.
Yeah, as a writer in America, absolutely.
That's
bizarre. It's been really positive for me to see that happening inside of online journalism.
Absolutely.
So why don't game developers unionize? And this also comes hot on the heels, of course, which we haven't talked about yet, but SAG-AFTRA seems to have come to the SAG-AFTRA strike seems to have come to a conclusion. They've reached terms which are, to call them a compromise would be very generous, I think. Pretty negative terms overall. They kind of held off some really bad things that the game companies were petitioning for, but they didn't get some of the larger asks that they wanted. It doesn't look like they're getting much more protection from stress vocal, from like stunt performances where they're shouting and yelling. They did secure some more information about the projects that they're signing up for, but nothing extraordinary. Like now they'll know if the game that they're going to be voice acting for will be a sequel or not. Not what franchise it's for,
they still don't know anything beyond that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So like, they don't know that they should negotiate for more money because it's a sequel to a huge blockbuster game or not. Right. They just know it's a sequel. And the big one that they didn't get was a bonus structure based on income. They'd wanted was frankly like not that much based on if a game was wildly successful, wildly popular, selling millions of copies. And they did not secure that.
Yeah, it's the precedent that would set that. I think my guess is they were less worried about actually giving a small amount of money that was residual based or royalty based, however you want to use the terminology, as much as the precedent set by someone that worked on a game getting a piece of the pie.
So the thing is, I've spoken to developers about this since this has happened, and they're all like, yeah, no, I've been at houses that do that 100% already. They do give bonuses for sales. So it's not like a thing that doesn't happen at all at some game developing houses.
It's codifying it that's terrifying to the shareholders.
I think that's what it is. Yeah. Like codifying it into a contract like that says this is a guaranteed thing and not it's a bonus, right? Like, oh, this is a little thing I'm tossing you for fun. Like, no, this is guaranteed if the game
is
part successful.
Of your contract. Yeah.
Exactly.
How much of an obstacle do you think it is, though, that, like, just ideologically, it might not be the most fertile soil?
Oh, it's... Yes.
Because, like, You know, a friend of mine who's a game developer once said that the entire industry is people who all get into it because they think they're going to captain the ship and never imagine they'll be the ones pulling the oars.
Right.
And I think that that describes a lot of people and their values who get into a lot of aspects of tech. But, like, just ideologically, they identify their interests with management even when they are explicitly... when they explicitly do not share those interests, even when management explicitly has interests that diverge quite a bit from theirs, there's sort of an ideological tripwire that's like, well, I'm part of the system, and someday I'm going to get mine out of it.
Totally. I think that
could be an issue.
That alignment with, like, the tech industry, the fact that games are a tech industry, or, like, they're tech and art overlapping, tech and entertainment overlapping, but that tech industry center is, like, so anti-union, so anti-organization, largely for, I think, that ideological reason, and also a kind of a larger technocratic ideological reason.
Believing in a meritocracy. Yeah.
Right. But also because there's lots of replacement labor. It is...
100%.
It is... I mean, like, so, Patrick, you just reported on the ESA thing. The ESA came out to support a Trump. They said the Trump administration's bold leadership in STEM, not field, but
yeah,
STEM
it was a
grants or something,
dollar
right?
Investment, which right. of course comes amidst proposed budget cuts,
of course,
seed budget cuts to the Department of Education. But.
And I was like, you were ready to go in on it. I was like, all right, how's he going to go in? Like, I could tell he was mad. And I was like, how's Patrick going to go in on it? And in my mind, the one that I go to is like, well, of course, investing in STEM. Is a way to make sure that there's always young, fresh workers who are willing to, like, step in when somebody else burns out and leaves the industry because the games industry has a very high burnout rate. You ended up just going the other way, which is just, like, lobbyists fucking suck, and, like, the core ideology of all lobbyists is keeping the status quo intact, which is also true. But I think one of the big reasons that game developers don't unionize is it would be very easy to find replacements for a lot of jobs. Not every job and not every person. There are lots of people who would be, if not irreplaceable, really hard to replace. But the, like... in the trenches worker would be very easy to replace.
Yeah, I mean, you would need management to be on board with unionization for people to feel comfortable. Like, you need people with something to lose, which is management, getting on board and providing cover. But that is antithetical to the unionization because that's worse for management. But, like, if it was said, hey, it's okay if you unionize, like, we support you, then maybe they would.
Right.
But especially you would need so many junior people who – have just gotten in, don't want to rock the boat.
Yep.
Once you have an entrenched interest, like, you don't want to rock the status quo because that is potentially against your interests.
Personal interests, right.
Yeah. I don't see it ever happening. I think it's possible that maybe at some point, like, maybe there's a studio that unionizes.
Yeah.
I think what you would hope for eventually was some sort of studio with a progressive mindset. Like, encourages, like, there's like, provides a model. Like, the reason that, like, that's part of what, like, Gawker did in online media was, like, provide a model for, like, yes, you can be an online media outlet and unionize. Like, it's not, like, and once the model's established, then you have something to point to and build on. So, I don't know that it's hard for me to imagine the industry fully adopting unionization. But in the same way, I don't ever expect all of online media to adopt unionization. I can imagine a world in which, like, studios adopt unionization and that they just learn to cope with it. Not even cope's the wrong word because that attaches a negative connotation to it. But it's integrated into the way they function as a studio. At that, then you see other studios following that. But you need someone to take the first step forward. But that first step is difficult.
That first step either has to happen from someone in management who really believes in this as an ideal, or from in a position where the risk of saying no, you can't unionize is outweighed by the risk of people unionizing, and so management is forced to let them unionize without firing everybody, right? Yeah. Like, that is at the end of the day, the entire notion of a union is that, like, through collective organization, through collective bargaining, you can end up getting rights that you would otherwise not have access to. You end up having better pay, more security, better benefits around things like healthcare, because all of you are going at once and being like, hey, this is super important to us, and, like, if you don't give us this, like, we're out. And you need to be in a position where you can actually make that threat a viable threat and one that, like, your employer will be like startled by that threat. And right now there are not a lot of people in this larger field of like major game publishers who would be shaken by that. But, you know, I don't know, like maybe it's also hard to see, because the other fear is really like, if, for instance, every developer did get residual payments, which I believe that they deserve, on successful games, people will often say, well, won't that just like shake up everything and make games like not profitable to the degree that they are now? And the answer is yes. And yes, that would be like disastrous for a lot of companies. And for me, that isn't an illustration that it shouldn't be done. It's an illustration that the current model is not equitable and sustainable. Yeah. It can't be. It's not both of those things. It's sustainable
like,
only
like
if it's
movies,
inequitable.
Movies does it. The movies are still made.
Right. And they're still fucked up in some ways. Like, you talk to any visual effects person right now, any like CGI creator in Hollywood, like there have been lots of problems in the last 5 to 10 years in that field, yeah, because those movies have done super well. Movies like the Avengers and that whole series do super well and have historically in some instances not paid super well to right. those people who don't get residuals, despite the fact that they're the ones who are animating these huge
wild
fight scenes.
They made 90% of what's on screen.
Right, exactly.
And many scenes, yeah.
And so like that still has problems. But yes, Patrick, exactly. That's an industry that had that fight and like restructured itself, yeah, so it could be both more equitable, maybe not utopian, but more equitable and sustainable enough to continue functioning. And like, I want us to have that fight. Like, I want everybody who works for Ubisoft, all 80,000 people, to be like, I'm not coming in tomorrow.
You're in the UB union.
The UB union.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other thing, is there are things that claim to represent the workers of games.
Sort of guilds-ish.
But they are not unions. Right. And you've seen splits from some people who had wanted them to be more union-like. So things like the independent game developer, is it the IGDF?
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, hey, this theoretically is a union, or this is not a union. This theoretically is a workers' organization, yeah, but it doesn't actually do much outside of kind of loose advocacy. So, like, I would like to see one of those develop into a bigger thing, or I'd like to organically see what Patrick is saying, which is like,
yeah,
a studio decides we're going to give the world a model.
Yeah.
I wish we lived in a world where game developers all got well paid and weren't crunching all the time.
Also, healthcare for everybody.
Yeah, please.
You know,
just generally
universal
speaking.
Education and healthcare. Those would help
Patrick,
the game industry.
Do you have an answer yet to what game you want people to play? Because I have a follow-up to that that is similar.
Should we do another question?
We should definitely do. There's definitely one more, but I just need to read this one bit because I wanted to get Patrick's answer, which was this person generally just wants to know if the woke gamer himself has ever gone back to play World of Warcraft, because you once wrote about how you should play it, but you probably wouldn't.
No, I think I wrote about it because I wrote about it in the context of you should understand how an MMO works, just to know how it works, like just in the mm-hmm. service of like what I did.
So can I give you? Can that be your answer for the game you want someone on the podcast to play?
I want the woke gamer to play World of Warcraft.
Yeah, there you go.
All right. Well, this last question is related. This comes in from Patrick, who says, greetings to the Waypoint crew from Texas. I hope everyone is doing well today. I also hope you may be able to shed some light on something that has caused a little bit of confusion for me. Do you want to read the rest of this?
Why me? I don't want to read the rest
of it. Okay, I will. What does woke mean?
Oh,
is it a bad thing or a good thing? I feel like the word was used sincerely for some time, but now it feels like people are using it ironically.
That's a deep question.
Am I correct in feeling that like the meaning of the word has changed? How do you keep up with internet jargon if people change what the words mean all the time?
Boy.
Thanks and congratulations.
Oh man, that's I love the
what is
that
corn
line
cobbing?
Itself.
Yeah, it's really
what
good.
Is corn cobbing? And then there was a sound.
There was a sound. Thanks and congratulations on 100 episodes, even if this email gets read much later. Got read on our 100th episode. We did it once.
I think everybody who is highly active on the internet, especially Twitter, has some form of like irony poisoning in some ways. And
they're trying to drill into.
Yeah, people are drilling into
with their
our
irony
drilling right next to us. I do think that the word woke was a word that was used sincerely for a hot minute.
Yeah.
And I do think sometimes people still use it to refer to other people as, you know, being like progressive and kind of having a grasp of the shit that's going on and being on the up and up. But like, I think everyone who uses Twitter excessively has some form of irony poisoning and just kind of like repurposes these words to be.
Well, like, I think in this case, it was repurposed, and the second it was repurposed, the second that, like, woke comes from black culture.
Yes, 100%.
The second that like very corny white politicians started using the word woke, mm-hmm. it was dead.
That one guy from Canada, the guy who like loves Drake, the Toronto yeah. guy.
Uh-huh. Oh boy.
Yes.
Yeah, he was using it like a lot.
So like the second that, go ahead.
Oh, I was gonna say like, and there was also when it became performative. Like yes. we talked about this when yeah. we were discussing the allegations against Nick Robinson. Is like performative wokeness in which you. Pretend or act as though you are aware of like larger systemic structure. It's like a larger term for, you know, like being acknowledging sexism and racism and all sorts of other things. Like when it became a performance, when it became like performative wokeness, that's also when the word lost a lot of it because it just didn't mean mm-hmm. anything. It didn't
necessarily... you're woke now, huh?
Right. Yeah.
Right. Like it's like just the same way that like when people would write pieces about like oh, I acknowledge like. I'm a feminist. Like, that doesn't fucking right. mean anything, right? Right? Like, there was a period where, like, a straight white male writing, like, I'm a feminist, I identify with feminism, and, like, writing that was instructive and
was a political
educational
action.
And it was a helpful, like, mm-hmm. ally action. And then at a certain point, it became, to co-opt a shitty term used by the alt-right, virtue signaling. It actually was what that is. Like, performative wokeness is virtue signaling, which is, like, co-opting
right. for personal gain
and action that you don't necessarily practice in your private life.
That's the big difference, I think. That's yes. the thing. I think that the moment for me that woke became a thing that you use as a diss almost, not fully, but like as like an eye roll at
only
least.
Only if you're kind of
throwing shade.
Gamer.
You throw shade. You know. Throwing shade also, explain, okay.
Yeah.
Also black culture. Queer culture also. Moment for me that is interesting and meaningful about woke losing its purely positive meaning is like we expect more. Like right. it is not enough to be awoken to the evils of the world. Like, oh, it's cool you're woke. What are you doing? Mm-hmm. What are you doing to address these things in the world that you are not pleased with? Like, it isn't enough to know that feminism is a good thing. It isn't enough to know that racism is bad and that right. like you know that the police are shitty. Like, thanks, bro. Like, what are you doing to keep me from being shot, though?
Right. It's like if you watch Dear White People when it was airing, like they used the word woke like a fucking ton, but like
seriously,
the way that yeah,
right?
but seriously, yeah. like they used it in the way that like it was made to be used, you mm-hmm. know, and again, like it is an AAV term that's been like co-opted by, you know, shitty white people to turn into some kind of ironic
bad joke.
Thing, yeah.
Well, I think the thing there too is like, for me, one of the things that is okay about that turning around is a lot of the people who I saw first using it as a negative term, it was like other black people on Twitter looking mm-hmm. at white people who were themselves using it right. like, oh, I'm like people who are saying like I'm proud to be woke, and it's like bad. No, you can't bad. Just bad. Like, do something.
My warlock is a level 289 awoken female.
I hate you yeah. so much.
Yeah.
Destiny, hit yeah. me up.
Patrick's face is really good.
Yeah.
Oh my god. God, the awoken warlock is friends with the woke gamer.
Is that your new persona for PAX Wrestling?
The awoken female warlock?
No, I do have a new persona that will debut at PAX East, I'm sure.
Ooh,
hell yeah.
Tease. All right, I think that is going to do it for the woke gamer is back.
Are you going to be an Arby's social media person?
Real quick, Waypoint's Twitter is the absolute best because I tweeted at Arby's and I somehow got them to agree to play video games with me as long as we're playing an anime game with Patrick.
Oh, is that why you want him to play Naruto?
I always want him to play Naruto.
Like Arby's, their social media person is like aware of me. And these meta jokes in mm-hmm. a way, like, did they go back and research it? Did they already know?
They knew.
I want the answers in the same way I want to know why the ground disappeared.
Here's the thing is they don't have one social media person, and I was struggling with this Ooh. Yesterday because I was looking for who runs their social media. I think they do a lot of outsourcing and have like multiple people, but I think they have one person who like knows games.
Right, they tag that person in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They
expose.
Them. Yes.
Waypoint exclusive.
Are you woke about Waypoint? Mm.
I'm going to end this podcast right now. Shout outs to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. Find out more information about that track and the rest of Bowen's music at waypoint.zone/BOEN. Thank you, Danielle, for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Danica, for being on the
You're
show.
Welcome.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Patrick. People know where to find us already, so I'm not going to go through all of our Twitter. Shout out to Rob Schulte, Rob K. Hey, Schulte Rob. On Twitter. It has been 100 episodes, so shout out to everybody who's ever made this possible. Shout out to Joel, who was in recovery after some surgery. He's doing well. He's just, you know, recovering.
He's getting better.
Shout out to Dylan, who has been a producer for us for a long time. Shout out to Tim Barnes, who...
Shout out to also Basement Downstairs Tim. The first editor
Downstairs
of
Tim.
Mitch. Oh, Mitch.
I have it down here. To Mitch, who edited us back when we were in the bunker. Shout out to Natalie. Shout outs to Eunice, who isn't with Waypoint anymore. And mm-hmm. Who's real, but shout outs to Eunice, obviously. Shout outs to everybody who's ever helped us do the podcast, who's helped us with lighting, like Danny Brothers and CL, my boss. Mm-hmm. Shout outs to Rick in Legal. Mm-hmm. 100 episodes. We did
100
it.
Eps.
100 eps. A year of this, Vice Gaming's new podcast.
Oh, yeah.
You can find us on Twitter at twitter.com/waypoint, at facebook.com/waypointvice, over on Twitch at twitch.tv/waypoint. It looks like we're going to get YouTube archives back up soon. That's youtube.com/waypointvice. I have a meeting in 10 minutes, so I'm going to run and go do that. Danielle, what is it that we say to him?
Be good and be good at it.
Peace.